What's the earliest you can remember back?
Pardon?
The earliest you can remember back.
Well, you say Prohibition. I've seen John Barleycorn buried at a couple of churches in Columbus Grove, Ohio, the night that Prohibition took effect at midnight. And I was there. The big whiskey bottle laid out in the coffin. I seen that done. And, of course, I've been in the old open saloon is better than what we've got today. Much better. The only time that you seen a woman in the old open saloon was when she was in there after her husband take him home. Today, they're in there drinking as much as everybody else. And you see, liquor has broken up many homes. And it'll do it to you every time. That's one of the things these meetings I go to, I just don't like this sort of thing. To show you, to tell you one of the sad things in my life, you know, up west of Telegraph Road on Dunbar, you remember where the little curve is? That two-story house there, hollow tile. It's, I think, above. It seems to me there's some wood in it, but most of it's hollow tile. I remember the people that built that house. That would have been back, oh my goodness, I don't know, I suppose around 25, maybe, somewhere around there. He was a mighty good man and a good mechanic. And I've been to many parties that they had been to, and she would take a glass of beer and, oh, don't this look good, Herb, don't this look good? Herb Sanders is his name. And I told her, I don't know how many times, that every time I guess that she said that in front of me, I'd say, well, why don't you help the man, not hinder him, tear him down? Anyway, she kept on, and then I kind of lost track of them for a year or so, something like that, maybe a couple of years. Well, I knew they built that house out there, all hardwood floor and a garage and everything. He was a mechanic down the American Garage. Well, that was right at the end of Smith Street. It's not there anymore. It's right beside that old blacksmith shop or radiator shop. It's
what I knew. I used to live right there.
Yeah, you did.
Mm-hmm.
Who was your mother?
Ruth Van Bell. Used to be Treacle.
No. Johnny Joy used to live there too. Joy's. Anyway, she, we built out on Telegraph Road and we moved out there, wife and I and family. And this was in, no, I think probably in the spring of 1930, somewhere around there, 29, 30 along in there. And I come home one night from work. I'd been there about 2 weeks, I think, and I hadn't had a chance to get over to see them yet. I knew that they were there. But they had already lost their home and everything they had. And they were, he was running that little garage there on the side, right there close to me. It's where Simpson's got his body shop in now. Anyway, there's a big square house on the corner, and they lived in there. And they had a son by the name of Bob, and Bob came running over, and he said, my mother'd like to have you come over. She'd like to talk to you. And so I went over right away. I stepped in, I guess, told the missus that I was going over there, and I went over and see what she wanted, and I went into the one of the worst, I'll tell you, traumatic things you ever can step into. Their furniture was nothing but absolutely junk. And I walked up in the house, it was right at supper time, and he was sitting like at that, right there, and she was sitting like you, and I was sitting here. He was in a drunken stupor. He didn't know I was there, trying to eat sardines out of the can. No tablecloth whatsoever, and just an old, dilapidated table and chair. And, well, just no furniture in the house, you might say. And I don't remember what she even wanted me for, but she, whatever it was, something was said, and she went to making a little fun of him. And I said to her, I said, Mrs. Sanders, you remember what I told you a few years back? Try to help him, not hinder him. She broke into tears and says, yes, my God, Eric, but I never thought it would come to this. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is look around you. That's all you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Does the name Isaac Einstein mean anything to you?
Pardon?
Isaac Einstein? Ezzy Einstein?
I don't...
They were two Prohibition officers back during the Prohibition time. We just learned about them. I wondered if you remembered their name in the headlines. They would go in and arrest all these people who were making liquor. Moe and Izzy, or Izzy?
No, well, that kind of brings back some memory, but I don't remember. No, there's a place for some of this stuff, but not social. Social drinking is the worst thing we've got.
Yeah.
And of course, I belonged to an outfit one time, quite a few years back when my wife was living, and they had a meeting, a retirement party for somebody, and somebody spoke up right away and said, well, we was going to put on a meal for them, and somebody spoke up and said, well, let's pay for the cocktails too. There were three people there, at least two people besides myself that I thought sure would go with me. Only one of them stood with me. And I said to them, I said, well, you have won now. They said, well, we think we ought to pick up the tab for the cocktails. And I said, if you was coming out to my place, you'd be welcome to anything you'd have, but there'd be no liquor there. Absolutely none. I said, I don't like people to buy liquor for me, or I don't buy liquor for anybody else. Now, I said, I'll probably drink a cocktail with you people there, but I'll pay for it myself. And so that night, when we got there, most of them were there, and when we got there, the missus went over and sat down, and the little gal come up with her pad and wanted to know what I wanted, and I told her what I wanted. And she brought it to me, and I said, now, how much do I owe you? And, nothing. This is going to be paid for. I said, I know it, but it's going to be paid. This is going to be paid for by me. And I paid it, so they seen it. It was the last time that was ever asked for. And we've been to other meetings when Mrs. Cupp, Hopkins, I think it is. No, Whitcup. Mrs. Whitcup. And I and, Johnny Arthur have said to him, why don't you go to a church where some of us people don't drink? And we've made that until I think it's turning around a little bit. There has been some times that they've taken it out to community college. And that's the thing that bothered me at the community college too. Maybe you've seen the article I wrote about the community college a while back. Well, there was an article in there that somebody was upset because they couldn't have liquor at some little function they were having there, and there had been an article in by one of the students there that was against it, having liquor, and I wrote quite an article on it, told him that I didn't see why he should have been upset, because in the first place, as I understood it, it was against the law to have any liquor open on a public place, and I thought that should rule out liquor at the community college or any school system. I don't know whether I made my point or not, but I see here a while back that the city council was going to allow liquor at some of the baseball games, I think, on recreation, and they finally backed away from that. And they should. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with liquor if it's handled right, but it isn't handled right. You've got any amount of people that can't handle it, shouldn't have it.
What do you remember about the Depression? You said something about those coupons and...
Well, ration points, for instance.
How old were you when...
Huh?
How old were you when the Depression hit?
Well, I guess I was probably at that time I was married, I think. Although, when it hit real hard, yes. See the crash coming for... 29. And in 34, I think it was when you let's see, 1934 was when you had a moratorium declared. You had 5 years to pay up any back taxes without any penalty or interest on them. Because there were so many people who couldn't pay their taxes, and it's happening right now, that they had to back away from it. I wrote an article on that.
Were you a farmer then, or were you teaching at the school?
Lord, no. I never had enough money to get to farming until I went into the garage business. And then it was only by happenstance. You see, when I built the... Well, first I bought a home out at the end of Rambo Drive on the right-hand side, down by the railroad track at that time. And for some reason or other, I was working drilling wells at that time and doing a lot of other things. Anything to make a dime, you might say, an honest dime.
And you were married at that time?
Oh, yes. Married and had, when I moved away from there, I had 2 children. And, but somewhere or other, work was going right down. And I guess it was another thing that I seen in the picture, and I don't know what. I often think that the good Lord tapped me on the shoulder and done something about it. I don't know. But anyway, I said to the missus that there's no way that we can finish paying for this place here if this thing's keeping on going down. And so I think maybe we might be better off if we went out on Telegraph Road and see if we couldn't trade our equity in this for some lots free and clear and build a garage house out there. And then we could get into the garage business or gas station or something else if we had to. Well, she thought that was all right. So I went to Corny St. Bernard and I traded him the equity for 2 lots out on Telegraph Road. That was just south of the garage that's there. That garage that I had is no longer there. It had been torn down a long while ago. And anyway, we hadn't much. Well, I'd done all the work that I could, and when I got the house up, all I owed on the house was about $315-$320. That's all I owed. And of course, that was already set up, but I could pay it off. It was wasn't a mortgage. It was just a note. Because my note had been good, and lo and behold, it got down to the point I couldn't pay anything when come 6 months rolled around. There's no way I could pay. Well, anyway, finally got down to only about a day a week drilling wells, and so I quit drilling wells and went to the gas station over on right there by Kmart's on the north side of north side of Stewart Road. Heiserman, I think, was run the last I knew. Anyway, Jake Liddle went in there with a brand new place. Ted Fleem had just built it. And I went over there and went to work in there. I had to pay him rent, and I don't remember what it was anymore. But I didn't get any profit off anything. If I sold parts, he got all the profit off the parts, and I got nothing on my own labor. Well, then I was there for, offhand, I would think a couple, 3 months, maybe more. I don't know, more or less, something like that. And in that time, we hadn't slid any. I'd got enough food for the family and paid my gas bill and paid all the bills as we went along. And with that, I said to the missus, we better build a garage out here so we get our divvy off of the gas and profit off the parts and other things. So then we started that. Well, we got into that, and it was pretty rough, but in a very short time, I was really going great guns. I tried to do good work. I didn't rob anybody. Matter of fact, I usually tried work about 50 cents an hour. Well, that was pretty cheap. But as long as I was feeding the family, I didn't care. That's what I was after. The first, the first 2 days that I opened the garage, the one night I worked to 4 o'clock in the morning, and the next night I worked all night. But it was paying some bills that I owed, and I was tickled to death to do it. And while I was paying my bills, even though I didn't get any money out of it, it helped me. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I knew, I went to doing pretty good. Well, I had to buy a few parts, and anytime I got a few bucks, I'd aim up on parts. Something was fast moving that I didn't want to run town for. The first thing I knew, I was, Norwalk Truck Line, if they was anywhere near me, they came out. And the Mr. Sal down on Monroe, run the warehouse, he told me after I left, he said they was having trouble finding anybody to do their work anymore. But anyway, I even had some of the doctors, Dr. McMillan, Dr. Karsh come out to me. And I finally got to the point, I had about 2 weeks lined up ahead. I couldn't get to it. In other words, I tried to have somebody help me. I had one fellow help me that had run a garage for a while, and of course I found out why he was out of business in a short time. There was a Gensler's tourist home down the road, and they used to send people to me. And they called me one morning and wanted to know if they couldn't come down there. And I said, well, I can't do it right now. I said, I'm busy, but I said, my next door neighbor here is not working, and if I can get him, I'll let him do it, and there's room in the garage to do it. And I said, I'll call you right back. So I went over and seen him, and he wasn't working. He'd be glad to come over and do it. And so I told him they could bring it down, and they got it down there. I think it was Noel Essex. Anyway, he cut the thing apart and went to put it back together. And when he went to put it back together, of course, I'd check on him every once in a while. Finally, he had I think the flywheel all in. And I never seen such a mess in my life. And I said, you can't put that in that way. I said, you pull them out of there and put the right bolts in there and put it in the way it ought to be. He said, you'll never know them anyway. You'll never see them again anyway. They're from Canada. I said, I couldn't care less whether I ever see them again or not. They're going to be paying me that job when it leaves here, and it's going to be right. So you might as well pull it out. You're going to put it in right.
It sounds like your parents were a reflection on you, as you say.
Well,
I sound very honest.
Told a good many years ago that don't lie. My dad, he was death on lying.
Did you ever lie to your parents and get?
Never. To my knowledge, I never did. My dad said, I don't want you to ever lie to me. He said, you can lock from a thief, but he said, damn a liar. That's exactly the way he felt. And I went in when I was a kid. I remember going in with a couple of buddies into Pease Hardware Store, and that was just at that time. It was just a new, that's when they had the tables out to start with like five and dime.
Yeah.
And we come out of that store, or it was noon on our way to school. We come out of that store, and we're just going down the street a little ways, and one boy showed me a little slipper knife that he had, a little novelty. And the other guy pulled out some kind of a knife or novelty he had. He said, what'd you get? I said, nothing. I didn't have any money. Well, he said, we didn't either. Well, I went home and told my dad about it, and he said, you stay away from those boys. He said, you'll be in trouble one of these days. And he said, you just stay away from them. If they want to go in the store, don't go in with them.
Yeah.
And he gave me some pretty good facts, pretty good foundation to stand on. And you see, my mother died when I was, it would have been about, let me see. Of course, I was working before then. I've been working for a long while. She died in 21, and I hadn't had my 16th birthday at that time yet. I was still doing, hauling logs and gravel and anything I could do, because I had a team and wagon that I owned myself. I bought and paid for them.
What age did you start working then?
What age did I start working? Well, I think the first working that I had done was about 1916. I think that letter that you've got there, of course, I don't want you to take that. I'll give you a copy of it if you want it.
Yeah, I'd like a copy.
I can do that very, very quickly.
Okay.
And I got another one here that that I can give you a copy of. I didn't. But anyway, I started in, I think, about 1916. That's when we moved out. I think that's when we moved out on the west of Commerce Grove. I would have been in the sixth grade. Well, just before the sixth grade, we moved out there in the spring, and I raked. She had a real big Aunt Jenny Jones. They were nice people, very nice neighbors, and I raked her yard for her. And lo and behold, you that winter. I think it was that winter. Why? And I'm not really sure if it was that winter or the last winter of school. Anyway, the next year I went to work on a farm, driving horses, cultivating corn, and well, driving for loading hay and on the hay rope and many things. And from that time on, of course, I always did get up reasonably early, but at that time I got 25 cents a day. Board room and washing. And I rolled out at 4 o'clock in the morning, and a good many times I was where I could go to bed around 9:30. But the next year, at vacation time, I got 50 cents a day, same people. And the next year, I went to work for a guy, Benrow, who was Mrs. Jones's son-in-law, and for board room and washing, and $20 a month. And $20 a month at that time was a full-fledged hired man. That was what the going rate for hired men was. And I went out and cultivated corn with a team of
my mother. Well, then we moved away from there. I think in about 1918, probably in 19. You see, I would. We lived up Vaquero. Well, I worked that summer, helped Dad on the farm because he'd rented 40 acres up there, and I helped him on the farm what I could and picked up any work that I could pick up around the neighbors that needed help. And then that fall, I started in the ninth grade in high school, or the ninth grade in school, and I had to ride 6 miles one way with my bicycle. Well, when it got cold weather, we had a horse and buggy, and I drove a horse and buggy when it got real bad weather, and put the horse in the sale barn until I was ready to come home at night. And the next year, I worked around there, helped Dad and doing other things that I could.
And but my mother got sick, and she had been sick. She was sick about a year and a half before she died. And of course, I'd done a lot of things around home, around helping mother and one thing or another. And then I started school in the tenth grade, but I only went about a week. And there's no way that I could.
That's all I want to. So I quit and went to work, and I got a job of $3 a day, boardroom and washing, driving team haul logs. I rolled out every morning at 4 o'clock, and my team had to be taken care of before I went to bed at night, usually about 9:30. And of course, you had to grease the wagon or any other thing you had to do. If you had anything broken, you had to fix that up. And I worked that way for. Oh, I don't know just exactly how long, but I think all that winter, and I think maybe toward next spring, and then I finally bought a team of horses, my own. Team and wagon and harness, and I got $6 a day for it with a team wagon and harness, and I had to furnish everything. And I hauled stone on the road. I hauled stone from the National Quarry from Lima, Ohio. I've hauled hickory butts from up around Slabtown by Lima, and I've hauled logs from all over around down in there, and I've hauled gravel from the best gravel pit. I've hauled stone from the Shoemaker Quarry at Vaughnsville, and from the Gilboy Quarry over Gilboy, Ohio. And I've been over to Arlington, the stone quarry, stripping with a team and a slip scraper. And of course, then the year my mother died, I was home helping my dad on the farm at that time. Matter of fact, the day that she died, they'd taken her to the hospital. Well, I was helping Dad changing thrashing. I was going as a full-fledged man, hauling, laying up a load of bundles, and taking them home and feed them into the separator. It got winter time. I don't know what time that would have probably been about the right. It got winter time, and of course, in the winter time, a good many times there was nothing much to do with the team in the winter time. Oh, you get a day here and now and then, but you didn't get very much. When you had to feed that team, whether you worked or you didn't. And I had to eat too, and I was paying board and room. So I was. There's a fellow come down from over here by Sandpit. You know where Sandpit is? Mm-hmm. Twin Lake Park? All right, you know the building is sitting there now? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you a little bit let me go on with my story here. He came down and wanted to hire my dad to come up and drive mules to haul cinders from the sandpit on the road, going into Mabee, because some of the fellows couldn't get to work. Bad roads. And Dad wouldn't go. He was a homebody. He wouldn't go. Well, I got to the point where any place I hang my hat was home to me. Anyway, he went back to town, and finally, I guess his son-in-law told him that, why didn't he ask me? So he came back out and asked me. And I said, yeah, I'll go. If I can get Dad to take care of my team while I'm gone. And he said, yeah, he'd do that. Of course, he could use them, too, if he needed them for anything. Make a dollar or two with them. And so I come up here supposedly to work for 4 weeks. I worked the 4 weeks, not home over the weekend, and then come back for another 4 weeks and went back over the weekend and worked a couple more weeks, I think, and went down and sold everything. I had a sale and sold everything and come up here and went to work at the sand pit. Now, I worked at the sand pit. I started in, I guess, on the calciner, where they made their own gas and maintained 1,450 degrees heat to burn the lime out of the glass sand. And I went from there, worked on that, greasing and all different things. And you had to make sure that it didn't go one way or another, because it rode so the sand could come down and kept turning on the cradle. It was so hot that you greased that with a grease stick. It was just like a candle almost, and it was a big cap, so there's air up in here. And you go down and take a wrench and tighten that up just a little bit. Of course, when it got empty, you'd put a new stick in it. And of course, if the thing went to travel one way or another, I don't remember which way you did it, but I think if it was going down, you'd take a little bit of sand and run on the top side of the carriage, and that would bring it back up. You had to be careful that you didn't come too fast. Well, then that went there, and it dropped off into water, what they call the washer screws. You wash the lime out after you burn it up loose. And I worked there for a while, and along in August, August the 9th, why, they needed somebody who was having trouble in the boiler room. And so I went over and asked the superintendent for the job in the boiler room, firing the steam shop, the boilers, the steam boilers. There was four of them at that time. They finally got five of them in. Well, he told me right off, he said, we don't want to be putting somebody in there all the time. I said, all I'm asking for is a try. Okay, go ahead. So I went in there. That was 7 hours a day and 7 days a week. And I had just turned 17. See, I come up here the February the 11th or 12th of 1922. Well, you figure 22, that my birthday was the 23rd of July, that would have been 17. I'm born 1905.
Were you born in?
1905.
Where at though,
when? Down in Ohio.
Oh.
Down in Columbus Grove. That's where, Jim Garrett came from, up at WJR.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Underworth down there, before he took Garrett as his stage name. Anyway, I worked on that and for a while, and I went to work in the boiler room then. And that was 12 hours a day and 7 days a week. 6 days, I burned up about 15 ton of coal a day. Scooped it all by hand. And I had to pull my own fires and pull my own ash pits. So I had a helper during the daytime. On a Sunday, I only kept one boiler going. I don't remember how much I burned up on a Sunday, but it wasn't near as much. No way near as much. But I had to pull my own fire, pull my own ashes, and I had to watch a pump over in the calciner, and a pump, two pumps in the pump house, and two pumps in the quarry hole, and then take care of the light engine. When it was dark enough, it had to run. And I worked there for about 9 months in that job. Well, then the night man wanted to go on days, and we went on 2 weeks days and 2 weeks nights, and I just couldn't take 2 weeks days and 2 weeks nights. So I asked for another job and got it. And I went to work and just roused about wherever they wanted me. And the first thing I knew, they long come one day, the superintendent's brother, and he said, come down here. And I went down and fired a steam shovel. And that was the easiest job I guess I ever had in my life. Anyway, that's where I was when they shut the place down. I was in Thanksgiving, day before Thanksgiving, 1924. And I went to town, and jobs were pretty hard to get right then. And anyway, I got a job, I think, with Dole's Garage, nights. Right there beside the family theater is where their place was. And I don't know how long I worked in there. And from there on, there's several things that I can't tell you exactly where the exact pinpoint every day or every time. But I worked there. I worked for Herb Sterling, hauling coal. I've been in a lot of basements around this town where you have to carry the coal in on your back, and I drove a truck and hauled coal and hauled, they had building materials too. And then I also worked at the paper mill.
Consolidated,
North Plant.
My dad worked.
Yeah, I worked, did he ever know Lloyd Richards? Lloyd Richards was my boss.
Sounds familiar.
Lloyd Richards was my boss, and I worked in there. That's the only job I ever walked off of. And I walked off a job just about an hour before quitting time. Because they usually depend on what I told them. And they had a habit of washing it underneath. And at one time they had slicker suits, and the slicker suit, the other machine, had torn up their slicker suits, that they come over and borrowed ours until they tore it up. Then nobody had a slicker suit. And I went down under there with no slicker suit on, and I'll tell you, it was really loblolly under there. And I told them after I got through and got back out of it, I said, no, if you want me to get down there again, you better have a slicker suit, because I won't get down anymore. Well, the very next week, there was no slicker suit. I think it was on a Thursday night, I believe. And I was working the afternoon shift. I think we quit at, seems to be 10. And about right around 9 o'clock, Lloyd come to me and he said, knocked the handhold plates off a number one vat, and we'll wash that number one vat out. I said, what about the bottom? Well, he said, we won't wash that out tonight. Said, okay, so I knocked the vat with the handhold plates off and went around the back to knock the one off the back. And Rosie, the tower boss, who was over Lloyd, said, what about the bottom one? I said, Lloyd told me I didn't have to do it. Oh, yes, you do. I said, where's the slicker suit? He said, I don't have one. I said, you know what I told you last week? Yeah. I went back and told Lloyd. I said, you know what I told you last week? Yeah. I said, I'm on my way home. I won't do it. He said, well, you know what that means, don't you? I said, yep, that means you're going to do it. Well, they had slicker suits Monday morning. Because I knew that, because Lloyd is that kind of a guy.
Well, what did you do for fun or entertainment?
Fun? Oh, my goodness. You read that pondering some of the time. We used to have more fun than you know what to shake a stick at. Many things. For instance, square dancing. I liked square dance.
Oh, yeah.
And shoddish. And for instance, I had a gal come up to me, Emil Hyatt's daughter, 5 years ago probably, out to the fairgrounds to buy tickets. And she come up and she said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, yeah, but I can't speak your name. She said, well, I'm married now, but she says, do you remember when you used to teach us kids over over Lambertville, Whiteford Center, and how to square dance, and we had the most fun. And she says, I'm doing that to the kids now. And she went on to tell me about it. I said, yes, I remember that. Matter of fact, I've got some of the, well, I got the old records that I used. I had to send away to get certain records.
Did you do that when you were a teenager too?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I went out after I got married, and before that I did, but George Milliman, and he was part Indian, and he was the best fiddler there was to play, really. I liked to call a square dance to him, and he liked to have me call, apparently, because I knew right where he was at. I didn't have to watch him at all. And he was always in time. His timing was real good. And but he called me one time and wanted to know if I'd go out with him to a special deal that they had out at the Detroit Beach Clubhouse. And I went out there, and boy, people come down and wonder, they never heard like that. But of course, it isn't Western, it was the old, our Michigan. We used to go from, tonight, we'd go over maybe to one neighbor and carry all the furniture out and pull up the rug and square dance in the house. And come 11 o'clock, why, we'd have, the boys always put in, I think it was 50 cents or something like that, and that would pay for the fiddler and pay for all the meat. And the women would bake cakes and one thing or another, and the older folks would play cards in all of the other rooms. And we'd square dance. And when we first started, I'd never square danced. And a friend of mine was a Collins at that time. Well, he knew that I'd bought some tickets, and he got to the numbers that he knew that I'd bought the number. He came to me, and he said, now you've got to dance tonight. And I said, I've never danced in my life. He said, you're going to dance tonight. Well, he got Walter Lippert's wife. Walter's dead now, but she was a Miller girl, and she knew how to square dance, and she took me through the square dance. That was the last time he had to coax me to get on the floor. And it wasn't long until I was calling square dances, and I called a lot of square dances. You know, well, first a couple walks enter, and there you divide. The lady go right out around the outside. Now it's honor your partner, and don't be afraid to swing on the corner with a waltz promenade. And a lot of them, all old calls would come back to me, I'm sure. But when I was teaming, when I was hauling stuff, or when I'd go to town, I used to go to town with some of the neighbors down there, and one of them told me here a few years back, said, we always knew when you were going home, because we could hear your mouth organ coming. Anyway, the kids don't know what fun is today.
Really? That's true.
No.
They don't have that.
That's right.
And if we do, it costs, you belong to an organization, or you go to the college and you take lessons. And
and they don't get the right thing, in a way speaking.
Yeah.
It's
got
to be
a lot that we...
It's got to be highfalutin, and that's for the birds.
Yeah,
we got a lot that you kids are missing.
Really?
And that's what bothers
you. You had a lot more responsibility, a lot more to do, a lot more. Everything, like my kids want to do, I have to pay. They have to pay to go.
Sure.
You know, and they just can't pick up and go out here with a group of kids. And
you see, you can make your own enjoyment if you want to. A lot of them think that, well, I live here alone. I think it was yesterday, that I done one washing of my clothes. And I do my own washing. I live here alone. No, I didn't make any apology. I don't make any apology. I thought you'd come to see me, not see the house.
Right.
And I started to clean out there. I wish I could get that where I do what I want to with it, but I not only got that started until things went to happen and I had to do some writing and I had to call away from it, so I haven't been back at it. But you see, I got to eat once in a while too. So, and I get my own meal. I went up to the border of you the other day and I took a meatloaf up there in the morning and we ate right there to the supervisors. That's where we ate. But this thing here, where you go, I'll let you know some of the things for that matter. But anyway, I've worked on practically any place. I worked on the shipping crew at the Northside Consolidated Paper Company. I remember one night in particular, I worked nights, and one night in particular, I and one other fellow, there was three of us, a checker, and then two fellows loading, and we was carrying it direct from the, bringing it direct from the corrugator, and coming out of the corrugator, it was damp, wet, and hot. And we went down to the warehouse, just out into the onto the dock, clear at the north end, and an east wind, 17 degrees below zero. We was carrying 128 inch sheets. We couldn't get in the door of the boxcar because it was too long. They wouldn't go in. So we had to leave them on the dock and run off the dock. And he and I know we would run until we was out of breath, and then we'd walk until we caught our breath, and then we'd run. And as soon as we'd get that loaded, we'd ride, because steam was coming right out of it, you know. And we'd ride back in and go down to the storeroom, and it was warm in there, so we could get kind of cooled off and back in shape till we got the next load. And I'd go down to the other end to get a load and come back. But I worked in most places. I've worked at the board and lining that used to be down where the on Winchester Street at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
We were loading out a bunch of cars one night there when the old man over there on the little store got shot in the finger. They tried to kill him and, about 9:30, 10 o'clock, I guess it was. And I've worked, as I said, around the herd starting, and I worked at the Dull's garage, and then I worked nights at the American garage, and that was right at the end of Smith Street, and Bert Nichols owned it. He and I guess Sid Eaton. Well, anyway, the Sid Eaton and Bert Nichols and another fellow was the county poor commission. Bert Nichols the chairman. He's been down there many nights, around midnight or close to it, getting somebody from, well, one night I remember he was down there, I think somebody out at Rockwood was in bad shape. And he got him in there and got a doctor for him. And there was nobody laid outdoors for want of help when that happened. And then people got the, well, the Fairview was demeaning. Well, that's baloney. I'd rather go to Fairview now than go to one of these convalescent homes. You go to convalescent home just to die, that's all.
Yeah.
Down there, when Walter Krause was down there, that was a going thing. It made money for the county. But they had a big garden, hose hanging around there. If you were down there and you could take that hoe and hoe in the garden if you wanted to. You didn't have to, but you could if you wanted to. And women could help in the kitchen, canning, any amount of things, because they had a big garden, they'd done a lot of canning. But they didn't have to, and you had a recreation room in the house. A lot of people you'd see sitting on the front porch in the shade, some of them out maybe mowing the lawn, you know. Some of them would go out and help take care of the cattle. They had cattle, they had milk cows, they had their own milk, they had their own pork, they had their own beef. And most of them was people that knew one another. In other words, a lot of people knew one another. My dad stayed with my sister and myself, my wife and I. I think, as near as I can tell, my sister and I was talking about that the other day, as near as we can tell, around 10 years, maybe a little, give or take a year or so, but around that. And last year he was up here, he was always a homebody, and he'd come and stay in the wintertime because he shouldn't stay down there alone in the wintertime. And said, well, now she apologized to you. I said, she did. And yeah. And I said, well, I didn't realize that. I guess I didn't hear her. Well, she says, didn't she tell you that she done some things that she had to do over again, she'd do them different? Yeah, but she didn't say who she, whether it was me or who it was to. Well, she says, that's all the apologies you'll ever get. I said, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Don't bother about it at all. So it never bothered me. I never went back with her either. And then I got another gal that, well, she kind of thought she had me, and that don't work either. And this gal here, when I met my wife, why, and we had just a little bit of time that we got together, and she had just lost her mother that year, I think, or the year before. And I was getting about ready to sit down. Of course, I was working 14 hours a day at that time. I was working off French Stone Company. A fire and steam shovel, at, I think fire and steam shovel at that time.
What year was that? Do you remember?
Uh-huh.
What year that was?
That was 1927. That was long in probably, it was the first September, because that's when she went teaching. And I could see that chemistry would seem to be right. She seemed to be the kind of a gal I wanted to have. And I don't remember now, but it didn't take me long to ask her if she would have me. And she said yes. And I said, all right. I said, I'm working long hours. And I said, we will, I'll see if I can't get some time off some weekend, we'll go and get married. All right. I said, okay, I'll get off. I don't remember what weekend, it was a weekend coming up. I said, I'll ask him so that I'm sure that they'll give me that weekend off. And we went down to Ohio and got married. And we got married, and don't let me forget that. I'll give you a copy of the thing, and I think it's very good. We got married by Reverend Certible, who was a Methodist minister who traveled with the Prince of Wales when he first came over to this country. I didn't know it when we did, but we did, and he told me, I found out about it, because we talked to him quite a while after we were married. And I'd do it the same way over again. I found out that these big marriages don't always tie the knot tight. And after knowing what I know, I don't believe in these big marriages. I don't believe in this, well, show, a lot of it. Not all of it, but show. I don't believe in that. I just, see, I still believe that if you can just stay humble, you don't need it, don't have much to worry about. Anyway, we went and got married, of course, and when we got married, we had $250 between the two of us in an old Ford pickup truck.
Oh, you had a truck, huh?
I had a truck, Ford pickup truck.
No horse and buggy.
No horse and buggy. And we finally moved into town. We lived there for a while, where Deal Store used to be, up above Deal Store, the old one. Not the new one, but the old one, the wood store. And then we moved, I think, over on Mulholland Drive. I think we lived there for a little while, I don't know, a few months. And and we got a place out on Stewart Road, and we moved there in the fall, and we lived there all that winter, I think. And then the next spring, we bought this place down on Rambo Drive, and that's where we moved. And we was there, I think, a little over a year. And of course, in the meantime, I think that I went to work, and then I don't remember exactly when. Oh, I know too, I guess. I think I was going to go to farming, and I went down to Ohio, and things didn't work out down there. And so out at the Fred Stone Company, I worked, to begin with, I worked as a bottle maker, with the bottle maker. We went out one night, I remember, after they shut down, and we had to put a new soft plug in the firebox, steam shovel. The steam shovel was, they had three steam shovels there that were used to dig the Panama Canal. And the soft plug had started to leak that day. And of course they would start to leak if they got a little bit of scale over, so that the water couldn't get to the soft plug, it would start to leak too hot. And we had to put a new soft plug in, and we went down there, and of course they never quit till 7:30, and it took quite a while to take the steam out of it and get it down and get the hot water out of it where you could work on it. And I know it got around about 11:30, I think it was, seems to be around 11:30, and we was in a hurry to go home because we had to come back the next morning. And I said to him, I pumped it down, and I said, I think that it's down where I can handle it now. See, if you have to pump the water down, or you can blow it down a pop-off valve, or I forget what they call it now. Anyway, it's a blow-off valve for the boiler. And you let the water down below the crown sheet, because if you don't go down below the crown sheet, the water will pull over and come down, hot water. Mm. And so I crawled up in there with a light, and of course when I pulled and I loosened up the soft plug, and when I screwed it down, I said, all I want of you is to have that new soft plug there ready for me right away. And he had it. I said, all right. I took it out, and when I got it out, of course, it's steam. The pressure gauge was down, but even with all the pressure gauge down, there's still steam in there. And the steam come down, and of course, he couldn't see me. And he went to holler, and I said, now, this hand on, I said, hand me that thing through here. And I could see him as far as the firebox door. So he handed it to me, and I put the new one in. As soon as I started it, steam shut right off. He was afraid I was getting scalded. Well, I didn't get scalded. I'd worked around too long. Well, anyway, I tightened it back up, and we pumped it up right away and got a fire in it and went home. And but I worked at that, and then I worked at the fire and steam shovel. And I often think the steam shovel was one of the old, as I say, they brought them down the Panama Canal when they quit the Panama, when they got through the Panama Canal, and they brought them up here and put them in the hole. And they used a 5-yard bucket down there, and one night when I was firing the steam shovel, I had the crew, Art Kearns was the operator, and Grandpa's all I can remember his name on a circle. It took three of them to run a steam shovel, you see, and this here had its own track, and it had a light engine that could go anywhere. All we had to have pipes to us with water and get the coal to us. And anyway, he come down, it was just 7:30, that was our time to quit. We didn't have a train, and we all wanted to go away that night. Believe it or not, working all that time, you wouldn't think you'd have any time for recreation, but we wanted to go away. Anyway, Art came back and he says, I think we're all done for tonight, I'm going to shut off the steam header. So he went and shut off his steam and come back, and just as soon as he got through, he just got back there and stepped behind the boiler, and he looked down and he said, oh my goodness, here comes another train. We got to load it tonight. He said, you think you can get this thing warmed up again so we can load it? I said, let's try it. So I done what was necessary. Wouldn't mean anything to you, but I turned the blower on, shut the water off, had the water pumper going, and stepped out and loaded the thing down, and I broke the fire up because we always banked the fire for the nightman to handle it. And then I had to reach up and turn the light engine on because it was just dark and we had to have lights. And of course, he had to work the water out of the steam line, because if you don't, water gets into the engine and away goes ahead. And so there's little silcocks under each end of the cylinder, so that you run it slow so that the water can get out of there. And he was working the water out, and finally the train came in, and he had just about the length of a full car, and that's when they used an eight-wheeler. An eight-wheeler, I think, was somewhere in the neighborhood of probably, 24 to 30 feet long. I don't remember exactly, but it was quite long. And he hollered back, and he said, what do you say back there? Let her go. And we loaded 135 ton of stone that night in 11 minutes. But they were just, I like to work for them, because they were just like clockwork. That old bucket come around here, and the circle man pulled the bucket and run the dipper sticks back to get it back so it would clear the car. And of course, he went to swinging at the time he went to drop in the bucket. And by the time he got swung in line with the bank, why, the bucket was in the pit and wide open. And that's the way I like to run, and we did. Anyway, we shut her off and went home. We still didn't lose much time, but we lost a little. But anyway, then I run a dinky down there, 40-ton locomotive with Westinghouse air brakes in it. And I hauled stone. I've even brought stone up on the bank from down in there. And we take railroad cars down there and load them with riprap and take them out, take two dinkies, take them out on the bank, going up the incline. Before you went out, because you're standing there on snows, and before you went out, you had no glass to show your water in there, because if you did, you see, with blasting, they might break a glass. So all we had was what they call a gauge cock. It was just a little thing with you can just open it a little bit and you'd see whether water or nothing but steam. Well, you had to fill it way up past the third cock, and that was high normally, in order to have water over the crown sheet, because you had to have water over the crown sheet or you could blow the boiler up. And you had to have water over the crown sheet before you started up that bank. If you didn't, you was in trouble. And anyway, then, of course, that was about the time that, that I guess that's about all the things there until I finally went out and went to run the garage on Telegraph Road. And of course, then from the garage, well, we built the garage over there, and of course, the wife and I lived there. We lived there till 39. Of course, my health gave way on me because, oh, there's nothing for me to be out at night. And one night I never will forget that it was snowing, and I felt like it was coming down the flu. I got where I could go in the house and go to bed, I think about 9 o'clock, and I went into the house and hadn't much more and got into bed and had a rap at the door. The fellow was stopped down by Denison Farm. That's where the new stone quarry, they were talking about that stone quarry. And he wanted to know if I would go down and help him out. And I said, well, I don't want to tonight, but I said, you go out there and stand by the road. I said, wait just a minute. And I said, I'll call, see if we can get another wrecker. And I called Earl Althaver down at Harry Mays, and he said, all our wreckers are out tonight, Eric, but he said, I'll send one out just quick as it gets back, and we ought to have one back here shortly. And I told him, I said, you go out and stand out there by the road, and they'll pick you up. And so he went back there, and I went back to bed, and I was in bed probably 5 minutes, and the missus said to me, you might just well get up and go out there. You won't sleep another wink tonight until you go and see that he's going. And I guess I knew that. So I went to the door and here it started to snow. And I called him, he came back and I said, come on in here where it's warm till I can get this thing straightened around and get my clothes on. And I called Earl Althaver and he said, no, the wrecker hadn't come yet. I said, don't send him out, I'll go down and take care of him. Went down, was putting a new car and the doggone gas gauge was bad and all I had to do was bring it back and check it out and see that there's gas in it, that's all they needed. But everything was drained, so I had to fill the carburetor too to get it started. Anyway, I don't know what time it was when I got through, but I just nicely got back in bed again when the phone called and there's a fellow up the other way with a flat tire. And it was snowing by that time pretty good, and I said to him, I said, well, you got a garage, all-night garage, just a half mile, as close to you as I am to you. And he says, just a minute. And I said, okay. And he finally came back on the wire and he said, Lou Tedder said for you to get down here. Well, Lou Tedder was a good customer of mine. So what are you going to do? So I went down. It was 1:30, I guess, when I got back in bed that night. And the doctor finally told me, he said, if you would shut that place up and quit it, so you had 8 hours, he said, you could probably make it. Otherwise, you've got to get out and get on the farm where you can get some fresh air. Because he said, if you don't, you'll be laying in a wheelchair, in a steamer chair all summer, or you'll be in bed if it's the wintertime. And he said, you're no good in bed. And, of course, I found out a lot of things that that happened. Anyway, I went out and went to farming, and that was pretty rough, I'll tell you, because I hadn't been able to get anything. When I sold out, I took the best offer that I could get, and that wasn't too good, but the only thing was that he was a tool and die maker and had a good job. And of course he was buying this for his stepson. The stepson wasn't worth the powder to blow him up, and he turned out that way too. He was no good, but it got paid off. I finally got part of it, and then I finally got, well, I traded a lot because they couldn't buy the stock I had. And so I traded that for tractors and different things, and finally went to over just around the corner from Hickory Park is where I started in. I rented 120 acres there. And I done combining and hay baling and one thing and another. And I was there for 2 years. And then I, of course, that farm sold because the gal that owned it died. And so I went on down. I bought a place on down on Minks Road. That was in 1940, well, it'd be in the spring of 42, I think, when we moved there. And, of course, I went from that farm. I farmed at Ben Chambers' farm.
Ben Chambers?
Yeah. You know Ben Chambers?
There's a Chambers that lives down.
Brother.
Oh, yeah.
Brother. Bob and he were brothers. Now, Wayne is Bob's son. Probably know Wayne Chambers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's Bob's son, and Bob was a brother of Ben. And Ben was a principal guy, so was Bob, for that matter. Anyway, I farmed those farms, and then finally we was over to a meeting and we seen this farm here for sale. So I bought this farm in 1948. Well, by that time when I bought this farm, I had everything, my neck was out a mile. But the good Lord been with me. A lot of other people, I couldn't commence to name the people that have helped me along the way, both male and female, and colored and white. And for instance, I come up here, of course it was kind of a sad situation when I came up here and bought this place. It was run to where it wouldn't, well, I don't know whether I got my seed back out of here or this field over here the first year. And 2 years, well, before we got in here, or after I bought the place, the missus had to have an operation, a goiter operation. Well, that cost quite a little, and lo and behold, you, within a year after we was in here, she had to have another operation, a serious operation, and what they didn't get the first time, because I had no insurance at all, and what they didn't get the first time, they got the last time. And when I went into the hospital to St. Vincent's, they sent me over there to emergency, and they put her to bed and took me in to sign her in, and they went on to tell me, said, well, how are you going to pay for it? They want so much money down. I said, no way, I don't have it. Well, how are you going to pay for it? I said, when she goes out of here, if it's what they tell me it's going to be, I'll have the money for you. That's all there is to it. So, okay. I said, you can look back. You've got your money for the other, which is in here a year or so, or whatever it was. I told them. And they looked back and, yeah, so it was all right. And so that was all right. Well, as luck would have it, I had a cow out here that one of my neighbors wanted to buy, and they came over and they bought her. Well, that was enough to pay it. And well, after a year or so, they wanted to get rid of the cow, and I bought her back at the same price, paid them back. But that was helping me just the same. And of course then we've every building on this place has either been rebuilt, it's been remodeled or rebuilt. Now, the garage out here, the garage was put up here new, that's where we lived for a while. And of course this here, and of course we broke tradition, the wife and I did. Tradition has it that one generation buys a farm, the next generation pays for it, and the next generation loses it. But we bought and paid for it in one generation. It's all paid for, been paid for some time. And by the grace of God, she done her share. She was 100%. And nobody knows how I miss her either. No, that's all there is to it. You've got a lot of memories, you see. A lot of memories, good memories. The last trip we made, as a matter of fact, I think that I ought to show you. The last trip we made was in 76, I think it was. The There is a picture up on Sugarloaf Mountain, up in Traverse City.
Do you look happy?
Well, she was, and I was too. And we came home, because I knew she was getting in bad shape, I knew that. Because she wanted, she must have thought this was coming, I don't know, she never told me that she did, but nevertheless, we'd been up to Traverse City, oh, I think in July. And there was a special meeting of the, I can't remember what they call it now, but a conservation meeting anyway. And we got home, and we hadn't much more than been home. Well, I don't know, maybe on the way home she talked about it, that she wanted to go down to our oldest daughter in Omaha, Nebraska. Well, she lived out to Waterloo. And I said, all right, because we had another meeting up at Sugarloaf Village along the first part of September. I don't remember exactly what day, but the first week or two of September. And I said, but I can't go right this minute. I said, because I've got some things I have to do, but I said, you plan on, I told her when, and I said, on a Thursday, we'll leave here a Thursday, and that'll put us down to our daughter's on a Friday night. We stay all there all night, Friday night, and all day Saturday, and Saturday night, and then we'll go to our son over in Minnesota. And we'll stay there for a day or two to leave you kind of recuperate a little bit. And then we'll come back over to Sugarloaf Village because we had to be there on the following, well, I think, seems to be Thursday morning. Or Thursday noon, I guess it was. Anyway, we went to, we went from here, left here about noon. It took me longer to get going than I thought it was going to take me, but I did, I finally made it. And so we went there and we got to, my daughter's and stayed there all night and all day the next day and all night the next night and then went to son in Minnesota's and stayed there until the following Wednesday, I think it was. Wednesday we came back through northern Michigan and came down to Sugarloaf Village. So we was there. We had to stop in Escanaba all night. And then from there we come on the next day and got down to Sugarloaf Village by noon the next day. And by the time we'd gotten there, she was just about whipped because she couldn't, she stayed in the room most of the time doing little things that she wanted to do. And once in a while she'd come out to see the meeting, but the meeting was about three or four steps up and she'd just come and look up, see what was happening and maybe talk to somebody that was out there or might happen to be out there. But. And then, of course, when we was through to come home from there, she was not too good. And we come home, I wanted to take her to the doctor. No, she'd be all right. Well, Monday, she made up her mind she had to go to the doctor. So I took her to the doctor Monday, and he checked her, and he said, no, this is pretty potent, he said, and if you don't feel better, I want to see you. First day that, if you don't aren't better right away, I don't know, you give her a day or two, I want you to come in here. Well, she didn't go in. No, she felt better. I kept kind of asking her, but I've always been grateful that I never tried to push anything, like the goiter operation she should have had, but she knows what she wants or what she needs, if I'd have pushed her to go to get the goiter operation and she'd have died in the operating table,
yeah.
I'd have felt bad. And so she worked at her own pace. Well, anyway, I kept asking her, and oh, she was better. Well, Saturday morning, she got up and she wanted to go see the doctor. And I didn't know it just like that, and I had some things already promised, and I hated to, I'd have taken her if I had to, but I had a granddaughter that would take her. And I said, well, we'll see if Ginger will take you down to the doctor's, and that way I'll be home at noon, I'll have dinner when you come home. But she never ate any dinner because I'd just finished my dinner when they came home. And Ginger was all upset. She was crying. She was in tears. And she says, Ami, she used to call her Ami, and she says, Ami, you got to be up at the emergency room, St. Joe's Hospital. I said, okay. I got right up, and she got quite ready, and we took her right up to the St. Joe's Hospital, and she went in there, and they kicked me out. Well, they never let me see her from the time I went in there, and her heart was beating about twice as fast as it should. Until I think around about, 5 o'clock or somewhere around there, getting quite late. And then the nurse came in, or the doctor came in and talked to me in the emergency room, and took me out and talked to me, and then we finally went up to see her, and hardly seen her until they kicked me out of the room and then back in again, and I could see, but she looked entirely different. They had her all wired up, but they also had quieted her down, so her blood pressure was down, and she was back almost normal. She looked different and sounded different. And I went back in and talked to her a few minutes, and he finally come to me and he said, well, no, you're going to have to kick you out another 15 minutes or so. And she'd been bugging me to, there was a chicken dinner over here at London Church that night, and she wanted me to go to that. And I said, I'll get to that, so don't worry about it. And when he kicked me out, I could see that she needed the rest better than it, more than anything else. And I said, well, I'm going to leave. I said, I'll go to the church supper. And I said, well, he said, you can come back in. I said, yeah, but you keep on to kick me in and out. And I said, that's not doing her any good or me either. And I said, she needs a rest more than she needs me right now. And so I come home and went to the church supper, and I was back the next day, of course. And from then she, well, just a day or so, and they put her back in the regular room. Wasn't long before she came back home. But as she came back home, she never got her clothes on. Here you can see her. That was at Thanksgiving time. That was the oldest son from Arizona and his wife. And this was just for Christmas. This is when she got dressed up.
She looks tired.
Huh?
She looks tired.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was when she got dressed up. And here's another picture of her. I was taken in Arizona at her brother's place. Her brother was her youngest boy. Well, yeah, her youngest brother, I should say. Mm-hmm. And here's a picture of her as she was teaching. That's when she went back teaching after the kids were all grown. That was another thing funny. Groves knew that she was a life certificate. And Mr. Groves, and he called her because he needed teachers. And she told me, she says, Mr. Groves called me, and she says, I think I'm going to go teaching. And what she wanted me was to tell her it was okay.
Right.
And I said, I thought you had a job. And she said, Mr. Groves wants me, and I think I'm going to go teaching. I said, well, okay, but I thought you had a job. And so I wouldn't tell her anything else either. And finally, I come in one day, over a long week, I guess, and she says, I'm going to call him and tell him I'm going to take the job. Well, I said, oh, I always thought all the time that you had a job, and as a matter of fact, I thought you'd already called him and what you told me. And that's all I said. Well, the next thing I knew, she told me, I called him and told him I'd take the job. once you'd done that, I said to her, I said, now I hope that you make enough off the job you take that'll pay the extra expense. I've heard people tell her after that, after she was teaching a while, she said, Eric was closer right than I thought. Well, you see, right off the bat, you have to have transportation, mm-hmm. you have to have different clothes, she had to go back to school, and she did, worked her tail off, you might say, going back to school. And one night I never will forget, she rode in to school, down to high school, Monroe, to take a class. She was taking it down there, and she'd ride in with one of the people who was going to Monroe and going to the class too, and I'd pick her up after class, about 9 o'clock, I think. And this night it was a glare of ice. Oh, it was terrible. And I had just gotten home, and I'd had an accident in Ann Arbor that I'd had a fellow by the name of Bob Hunt, lived over in Garden City, to go over and take care of it. And he had called me just after I got home. I don't remember now, it was probably 6 or maybe 6:30, not much after that. And he said, I just got back from Ann Arbor, and he said, I wouldn't go out, he said, tain't fit for man nor beast, and I wouldn't go out for anybody. I said, I've got to go to Monroe tonight. He said, I wouldn't go. I said, I have to. I have no choice. And I said, my wife's up there, and I'll be there. Well, I went down this way, and I got stuck over here, and I couldn't get up the bank, and I had to walk back and call Art Stoll, and he couldn't get me up the bank either. He had a truck partly loaded, and he couldn't make it up the bank. I finally said to him, I said, well, stand off to one side there. And I said, get your truck out of the way. And I said, I'll see if I can't take a run to jump at it. And maybe I can make it. But I said, I know that it's so slippery here that you can't get much of a start. But I said, I don't want to slide off of the bank there. And if you can get up there by that tree, maybe you can just put your hand on the back end of it to hold it. And, okay. And I said, now I'm not going to stop once I get started, if I can make it. He said, don't. He said, I can get back out of here because I got the truck loaded. And he said, I can go out the other way. So he helped me. The first time I tried it, I didn't make it. So I backed up and backed a little farther, and I tried it again. And that time I just broke over. Mm-hmm. Well, I went to get in the hold, and of course then I made it in there. By the time I got there, it was late. She'd had to wait there for probably 15 minutes, I imagine. Not too long, but about 15 minutes. And of course, she was standing there alone by the high school door. And I got her, and we started for home. And she said that one of the others wanted to take her home. And she said, no, I told him that I knew you'd be there. And the kind of a night it was, you know, you can't tell anything, really. But she was there. Well, anyway, I got there, and we come home the other way. And I guess we prayed ourselves home, because when we come down the other way, coming this way from the river, why, we had to ride on the wrong side of the road, because if we'd been on this side, we'd have slid in a ditch. There's no berm there to hold us. So we had to ride on the other side of the river, but as luck would have it, we didn't see anybody coming, so it was all right. And we've done that before, but I took her to school I don't know how many times over here when she taught over, I can't think of the name of the school, Herkimer School. Mm-hmm. And icy as all get out, she wouldn't drive. And
did she say that she felt the school systems were changing from when she was a teacher before you got married and then went back?
No, she didn't say that. I said that.
Yeah, I know, but I just wondered if
I think she's seen it too, because she and I don't know whether you ever knew Mrs. Schultz. And Mrs. Mrs. Schultz is dead now, but Mrs. Parker, I think Mrs. Siegert. I don't know, there's quite a few of them. I don't remember all of them, but there's quite a few of them over at Ida. And her with these other old gals, they were dedicated teachers. And they were in trouble with these new teachers for her all the time. your teachers wanting to do this and wanting to do that and grumbling. They wasn't getting enough money and they wasn't doing this and they wasn't doing that. And always in trouble. And those older teachers, the dedicated teachers, are kind of holding them down. I had one fellow tell me that she taught the ITA. Well, you know what that is or not. Well, I don't think it should be taught. I think it ought to go back. But you know, I think she done a good job with it, but I don't think everybody could. That's why I think it ought to go back to the old phonic system. In other words, the old McGuffey readers. And I got a full set of them there. I just bought. Anyway, she done a good job. That one picture was with her boss. They took her down to demonstrate down at Mason. That's taken out Mason School. Mm-hmm. And she went several places to demonstrate because I had the postmaster at that time, Slump, I think was his name. He used to drive bus, and he told me, he said, you know, he said, when Mrs. Rogers said, we didn't think that we wanted our daughter to go to ITA. We was afraid of it. But he said, we thought it over, my wife and I talked it over, and says we thought it over and we made up our mind that that's where we were going to have to send her. He says, we've never been sorry. He says, that gal went, their little daughter, and went to transferring over right shortly after and went to reading Marvelous. And he says that the one thing was she had discipline. I even had the bus transportation director tell me. He says, I don't know what she does in there. I think she stands them on their head, but boy, the bus drivers know everyone that comes out of her room. They know everyone that comes out of her room. She does have discipline. And I don't think that she had discipline. Well, she may have had some discipline. I don't know. But I don't think she had discipline like she had after she had raised her family, when she went back a second time. And probably some of the things, I don't know if it rubbed off on me or not. She almost begged of me to go and try to take the exam for college. Now, I don't think going in, that isn't what she was talking about, I don't think. Although it might have been, that isn't the way she said it, the way I understood it. I said, no. She said, you can pass it, I know you can. I said, what would it prove? It wouldn't prove anything. I said, I'm not even going to waste my time. And the other thing was, and this here is one of the things, now she had made a map, a plaque for the conservation, the state conservation district, women auxiliary, out of blue with gray, a gray plaque on a blue background of the state of Michigan, the whole state. Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula. And I'm just trying to think where, I think I got a picture somewhere, but I don't know where I can lay my finger on right this minute. Anyway, she hadn't quite finished it before right toward the last, it was getting pretty close to the meeting. Up in January, we had meeting, I think it was up in Midland, I believe. And Mrs. Smith, who is now passed on, down from Erie, wanted to finish that for her. No, she said she'd finish it. And she did finish it. And so I went up, and she insisted that I go to that meeting. So I went to that meeting with them and come back. Well, a short time after that meeting, I think it was, there was a meeting over here at the High Regency Hotel of the Michigan Association of Fairs. And we always went to that for every year. And she insisted that I go to that. I didn't want to go. And she said, well, you take Marlene, my daughter-in-law. She says, I think she'd enjoy it. Okay, so I took Marlene and I went up there. And when I got home that night, she asked me if I enjoyed myself. I said, no. She said, oh, no matter. Didn't they have a good program? Yeah, that's a good program. Wasn't the meal any good? Yeah, the meal was good. Did Marlene enjoy herself? Well, I said, I think she did, as far as I know. She didn't say, and I said, but she seemed to enjoy herself, as far as I know. Well, why didn't you enjoy yourself? Well, I said, there's one simple answer to that.
She wasn't there.
I said, I would have felt more comfortable right there in the chair side of you. I might have been asleep, but I'd have still felt more comfortable than I thought you would. She said, I would have. Well, I said, that's exactly the way it's been. And I said to my daughter-in-law from Arizona one time, I said, the only thing that I always felt bad about, and I have, see, the day that she died, I had a bunch of stuff to do in Monroe, and I promised her to be there. And she'd gotten up, I was thinking of taking her to Florida, because she wanted to go to Florida pretty bad. And I thought she would make it to Florida, because I'd been down to see the doctor. I don't remember what day she did die on now anymore, but I went down to see the doctor, I think on a Monday or Tuesday. I think it was only the day or two before that, and telling him that we had gotten the last prescription filled. You may want to change the program somewhat. And he said, well, I'll try and get a hold of the specialist in St. Joe's and see what he has to say about it, forward with him, and I'll get back with you. And I said, okay. And of course, quite a little while before, well, just before she died on the 9th. And on the 6th, I believe, it seems to me it was the 6th or 7th, I got a letter from her sister-in-law. And her brother, that was the youngest, that was the only one left. Her dad was gone, her mother was gone, her stepmother was gone. And her older brother died at our place down in 46, down in Erie. And we had to take him to Chicago. He was buried in Chicago. And anyway, the thing that happened was when this letter came, I opened it and read it. And of course, I had no intention of keeping it from her, because I never done that. I hadn't done that at all. And Doc told me, he said, level with her. I said, well, I do. And when I called him in December, when her brother passed away, first thing he said, I hope you're not planning on going to the funeral. He said, there's no way that she can stand it to go to that funeral. She'll never make it. Well, I came in and told her about it, and I told her, I said, Doc says there's no way that you can make it to that funeral. Of course, she felt mighty bad, her youngest brother, and she couldn't go to the funeral. And I said, well, Doc, that's what Doc tells me, and I said, I'm quite sure he's right. See, she hadn't even had her, well, she had started to put her clothes on at that time. Anyway, the thing that happened when Marie, her sister-in-law, sent this letter, I opened it, of course, and her she said that was she wrote it on the 4th, I think, of February. She said today would have been Bill's birthday had he lived. And when she read it, I could see right away that there was something happened to her. And nothing that you could tell, you know, couldn't put your finger on it. But anyway, for some reason or other, when I went to go to this meeting down there, she was quite a bit better. And I told the doctor she was better. And she got up, was talking to the kids, and well, you're joking, you know. And I was in a hurry, and she said, "Now, don't forget to stop in and leave a memorial over at Kapow Funeral Home for Mike Schultz. He was laying over there, of course." And I said, "I won't." I had a lot of, oh, I had a lot of places to go, and one place in particular was important that I be there. And so I was there and taking care of that, and was, I just was going out the door when the phone rang. And the guy said, I heard him, because he was behind me, but I heard him say, "Yeah?" And he spoke loud. You know, and I thought, well, he must be talking. I wonder. I turned my head, and sure enough, he held the phone to me. He wanted me to go back to the phone. I went back to the phone with my daughter-in-law. And she told me, she said, "Well, I'd like to have you come right on home, Dad." She says, "Mom took a turn for the worse. They're taking the hospital." And I said, "I'll be right home." And then, of course, she warned me to be easy because there's a lot of ice. It was an icy day that day, February the 9th. Ice and snow. And I said, "I'll be home, I'll be all right." So I come home, and she was waiting here for me, and I didn't know where she was even being taken. She was taken down to Memorial in Monroe. The doctor told me afterwards, he said, when I first got there, he said, she still had heart rhythm. And he said, "I thought there was one chance in a thousand that if we could get her into an emergency, and they knew when she was coming, that if they get adrenaline in her bloodstream right away, they might be able to save her." He said, of course, they weren't able to, but he said, you know, she still had heart rhythm when she got there.